This morning, instead of the reading that I listed in the order of service, I'm going to bring you another very old story. I'll tell Eddie. It's called The Rabbi's Gift. Once a synagogue had fallen on hard times. Only 5 members were left, all over 60 years old. In the mountains near the shul there lived a retired rabbi. It occurred to the 5 to ask the rabbi if he could offer any advice that might save the shul. One of the members and the rabbi spoke at length, but when asked for advice, the rabbi simply responded by saying, "I have no advice to give. The only thing I can tell you is the Messiah is one of you." This member, returning to the shul, told the 4 members what the rabbi had said. In the time that followed, the rabbis wondered about the significance of this old retired rabbi's words. The Messiah is one of us? Could he possibly have meant one of us? If so, which one? One of the rabbis asked, "Do you suppose he meant Rabbi Ephraim?" "Yes, if he meant anyone, he probably meant him. He has been our leader for more than a generation, even though he is often arrogant. On the other hand, he might have meant Rabbi Jacob. Certainly Jacob is a holy man. Everyone knows that Jacob is a man of light, but probably too naive to be the Messiah. Certainly he could not have meant Rabbi Caleb. Caleb gets crotchety at times. But come to think of it, even though he is a thorn in people's sides, when you look back on it, Caleb is virtually always right. Often very right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Rabbi Caleb, but surely not Rabbi David. David is so passive. He lets people take advantage of him. But then, almost mysteriously, he has a gift for always being there when you need him. Maybe David is the Messiah. Of course, the rabbi didn't mean me. He couldn't possibly have meant me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet supposing he did. Supposing I am the Messiah. Oh God, not me. I couldn't be that much for you, could I? In the months that followed, the old shul members pondered the words of the retired rabbi. The Messiah is one of us. As they thought about this possibility, they all began to treat each other with extraordinary respect on the off chance that one among them might be the Messiah. And off the off chance that each member himself might be the Messiah. They also began to treat themselves with extraordinary care. As time went by, people visiting the shul noticed the aura of respect and gentle kindness that surrounded the 5 old members of this small shul. Hardly knowing why, more people began to come back to worship at the old synagogue. They began to bring their friends, and their friends brought more friends. Within a few years, the small shul had once again become a thriving congregation, thanks to the old rabbi's gift.
So this morning I determined that we'll talk about universalist love. Working on the sermon, I got to admit I bit off a big chunk. I thought of the hymn that was sung by our choir today as well. Spirit, open my heart. When you try to talk about a concept as big as love, we need metaphor. We need to think in terms that help us to see a much bigger picture than we can express in a few words. Our faith tradition came into being in 1961 when Universalist and Unitarian churches in North America merged. Unitarians outnumbered Universalists at the time, Universalists were the smallest group by a large measure. In the U.S., a factor of 5 to 1, a much higher ratio in Canada. In Canada, I believe this church is one of only 3 or maybe 4 Universalist churches in all of Canada at that time. And there was fear among the Universalists that they would be overwhelmed and subsumed by the Unitarians. But the Universalists had a vision of religion that many now argue will outlive any Unitarian influence. In simple terms, Unitarianism was a movement based on intellect, the brain, if you will. And Universalism was a movement based on emotion, the heart. The word Universalist originally referred to the idea that God so loved humanity that humanity, everyone, universally, would ultimately be united with God. The good news of Universalism is that there is no hell, or at least no eternal hell. Universalism, the idea of universal salvation, grew out of a reaction to the predominantly Calvinist dogma of the time that said the majority of humanity was predestined before their birth for a tortured eternity in hell. And nothing that anyone did in their lifetime, no matter how saintly their life might be, could change that destiny. That sounds totally bizarre to me. That's the fact. I still find it hard to believe that the majority of Christians in Halifax at the time when our church was founded in 1837 believed in such a cruel God. The strict doctrine of the church was that you were predestined for heaven or hell, and there was no way to know which would be your fate. The most saintly person among you might be a person predestined for hell. This has the effect, despite all logic, of people trying to prove that they were destined for heaven based on the righteousness of the way they lived their lives. But it also had the effect of demonizing those who were seen as living an ungodly lifestyle. Barbara mentioned the cover of the Order of Service today. It displays the Universalist symbol that was adopted in 1946. And the circle is said to represent the all-inclusive faith of Universalism. This idea of an all-inclusive faith grew out of the idea of God as love. And I'll endeavor to explain that a little more in the sermon. Nowadays, we conflate the ideas of Universalism with the idea of a universal faith. That wasn't the original basis of Universalism. It was the idea that universally we were all going to heaven regardless of our faith. The cross in that image is the symbol of Christianity. In 1946, the creators of the symbol described themselves as Universalists of Christian descent. Universalists were barred from the Council of Christian Churches at the time because they did not believe in Jesus as the only path to salvation. The cross is set off-center, and it leaves room for other religious symbols, indicating that there are many paths to the truth. The early Universalists were considered Christian heretics. They found justification for their faith in the Bible, specifically in the first letter of John, chapter 4, verse 16. God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. The central tenet of the Universalist faith was God is love. And Richard Trudeau, I brought his book with me, I think. Richard Trudeau, a union minister who identifies with Universalism, wrote this delightfully straightforward little book called Universalism 101. God is love, and from which I then will now quote. Many of us are unable to share our ancestors' faith. God is less real for us than God seems to have been for them. And for many of us, the word God is no more than a question mark, a name for life's mystery. At such a time, we can't but wonder, can this vestige of an earlier age still be of use? I say that it can, To me, God is love is advice for the journey. It shines light on our choice of religious paths. This venerable motto says to each of us, the experience of love can be relied on as a sign that you are headed in the right direction. It says, if the religious path you are following fosters loving relationships, then your path is the right one. God is love. Notice that this ancient Christian saying doesn't seem to make sense. We were taught, many of us, brought up to think of God as a person. And yet love is an abstract quality. How can a person be an abstract quality? Bingo. Part of the saying's message is that God isn't a person. God isn't an old man in the sky with a long white robe, as so many of us were brought up to believe. No one has ever seen God, says the biblical passage. But if we love one another, God lives in us. God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. Some modern theologians have suggested that the word God is best understood as a name that is most important, a name for the mystery of existence. Modern theologians suggest that at the most basic level, God is a name that people have developed to represent the answer to the perennial questions, what is the meaning of life? Why are we here? What is it all about? The old saying is advising us to focus on love. We humans are small and the universe is very, very big. The experience of love may be the closest that we can come to knowing what it's all about. And here ends the quote. So before I proceed, I need to clarify my terms. Love is a word that carries many different connotations. There are many definitions of love, often grouped under the rubric of the Greek philia, brotherly love, eros, erotic love, storge, affection, as between parents and child, and agape, a selfless love. This latter term, agape, is sometimes identified as the will to do good for others. For the purpose of this sermon, I'd like to use the idea of agape, summed up by Scott Peck in his book, The Road Less Traveled. He defines love this way. Love is the will to extend oneself for the purpose of nurturing one's own or another's spiritual growth. To which I would add, love is a happy state. If you're not smiling on the inside, you're not in love. Again, I find myself talking about will. Love is the will to extend oneself. And will, our human will, is still a mystery. With this definition of love, you can in fact love your enemy. In fact, we are called to love our enemy, to extend ourselves for the other's spiritual growth. To love another person, you must overcome your instinct to fear and be suspicious of the stranger. You cannot truly love another person or another group from a distance. Love requires direct human interaction. We spend lots of time talking about other people who are different than we are, and very little time talking to people who are different than we are. If we really spend more time talking to people that we think are different than we are, we'd find that they're not so different after all. So what did it mean to practice this concept of God is love in the past? To acknowledge that God is synonymous with love. Given this definition of love, the universalists felt called to love all the peoples of the earth. This meant a recognition that the faith traditions of those born in countries that were not historically Christian were as valid as Christianity. That led to a challenge of the dogma of Christ as the only path to salvation, and in turn to a broader concept of universalism, that all world religions were an attempt to understand the same universal phenomena. This love of all humanity leads inexorably to issues of human rights. So universalists early on were advocates for the abolition of slavery, for women's rights, for prison reform. Note that in all of these cases, universalists were allowing themselves to be led by their hearts. And that still characterizes the universalist strain of our tradition today. I'm sure you can appreciate the qualitative difference between support or action based on an intellectual recognition of injustice and support based on a love for the people who are being oppressed. I've told this personal story before, but when I worked as an engineer, I had a supervisor. I was very fortunate to have some very good mentors. And it's possible to be a manager of a factory and to love the people that work in that factory. And that's the way I felt about John Dunn, who was the manager of the factory I worked in Niagara Falls in Ontario. And I saw him recently after an absence, probably 6 or 7 years since I'd seen him last time. And he's quite a bit older than I am, but still very energetic. And when we were talking about the people that used to work in the factory, he was naming them all off, and he was telling me about several of them that he still goes to visit. Some were in nursing homes now, some were in the hospital. He's a factory manager. You know, he retired from managing the factory. And he gets up and goes out to visit these people years and years after he left the plant. Well, this same difference between being led by the head or being led by the heart applies to dealing with LGBTQ rights, or poverty, or refugees displaced by war, or those suffering from mental health issues. Our universalist roots feed our hearts and push us to take action. The manifestation of universalist love has not really changed over the centuries. The reading we used in our passage meditation was written some 2,000 years ago by Paul of Tarsus, attempting to help a religious community find a power that would hold them together in the face of fractious theological divisions. This power of love is at the heart of the concept of the loving covenant that binds this congregation together in the face of our own much greater theological, sociological differences. The board of this congregation is seriously tackling the question of how we can sustain and grow our congregation in the face of dwindling interests in a dogmatic religion and the competition for the attention of time that today's world brings. The story of the rabbi's gift that Margaret read before I began my sermon can point us in the right direction. I believe that it's the palpable love that exists in this congregation that holds us together and that will attract other people to join us. The rabbis not only had love for the other rabbis, but the idea that they might, in fact, be the Messiah called them to love themselves. And that sense of love that permeated the synagogue was infectious and attracted other people. And people are looking for that desperately. Of course, it's one thing to say that we should practice universalist love, and it's another to figure exactly how to promote that. As I've said, this is already a loving and supportive congregation. To see it grow, we only need to recognize the importance of that aspect of our being and determined to reinforce it in everything that we do. May that be our future. May it be so. Amen.